But John is a highly distinguished academic, and he's also a reader in the Church of England, and as I've mentioned, he's chair of trustees in science. He initially trained as a metallurgist and has held academic posts at the Open University, Nottingham University, and in Imperial College as principal of the engineering faculty. From 2001 to 2007, he was chief executive of the Council for the Central Laboratory of the Research Councils. He's currently chair of ATTRACT, an advisory board based at CERN in conjunction with other, this is gobbledygook, isn't it, RO Forum members, seeking to develop future disruptive technologies. He remains an active advisor to several worldwide universities, governments, and the European Commission, and is a non-executive director of a number of companies. John currently holds visiting chairs at Imperial College, Brunel, Cranfield, and Liverpool Hope Universities, and has honorary doctorates from universities in Romania, Ghana, and India. And he's a fellow of the Royal Academy of Engineering and was made a CBE in 2007 for services to science. And in 2010, he was made an officer of the Order of Merit of the Federal Republic of Germany. So we are very fortunate to have John with us. I hope you're suitably embarrassed, John, but you gave me this.
You asked for it.
And he's going to come and speak to us on a topic, Science as the New Priesthood. John.
Okay. Oh, don't clap yet. It may get worse. It's always embarrassing, isn't it, when you hear your sort of obituary read out before you start. of course, none of it makes any sense. I'm just a human being at the end of the day. I've been doing a lot of talks on the nature of truth in science and the concept of absolute truth being a real problem for scientists and quite often for Christians as well. The last time I was here in Redlands was for a friend's wedding at Redlands Parish Church some 45 years ago. It's good to see you've come a long way since then. I think we met in an old hall, if I remember rightly. From a background, I call myself an atomic anarchist at large because I spent most of my academic life putting atoms where they didn't want to be. So if you think tonight's talk is slightly anarchic, it's true to form, and we'll go from there. So we've got quite a lot to get through, and I thought we'd start off with this quote from Albert Einstein because I think this is a lot of the crux. We miss it. Imagination is more important than knowledge. I had a slide where the E had dropped off, and in other countries it was, gave some amusement, but I thought for a discerning audience like you, I better spell it right. But for knowledge is limited to all we know now and understand, while imagination embraces everything, far more than we ever will know or understand. So when we start to look at truth, are we going to look at truth in the particular, of the little bit that we understand, or much wider than that? I came across this headline in the Times about 3 weeks ago. We're in trouble if we can't trust scientists. It's all about psychologists, actually, so I don't necessarily care. Oh, I almost fell for that one, didn't I? If you're a psychologist, well, my wife is one, so I better move on. Last night I went to an opera in a little pub near where my flat is in London. It's about about a sixth of the size of this room. And literally, I would be here singing, and I would be sitting there. And it was Donizetti's Elixir of Love, if anybody knows it. It's about this phony doctor who's got all these potions that are meant to bring your loved one to join you. Of course, it turns out to be nothing at all. In fact, one place it was beer. But on the back, he said, of course it's true. Science says so. He held up a sign. And I always wonder who this person is who's called science, who says all these things. Who is he or she or it? Because right behind, you have to find out that there's a person somewhere in there. But when you listen on the radio, they say, what does science say? And I think, well, it doesn't say anything, actually. But this is one I rather liked. Science says drinking coffee helps people slow aging, lose weight, and cheat death. So I've had my half cup of coffee. I should be okay for the night. And if you're not drinking it, now's the time to start. But you find out that this guy, Bill Murphy, was the guy who put this forward. Is it true? I don't know. Every day on the trade program, I'm always hearing what scientists have done, and it's always a half-baked story, as far as I can tell. They're always wanting more money. This is the other one, ice cream before breakfast. What a load of nonsense. Of course, if you take more sugar before breakfast, of course you're going to be more alert. But here we are, science says, or the study says, that eating ice cream for breakfast may improve mental performance. I'm sure it does. I've never tried it. But you might like to do a field test here. Give ice cream to everybody, see if it wakes them up. Anyway, if you eat ice cream, you have faster reaction times and less mental irritation, whatever that may mean. But science says, okay. What is the truth and what is the... Oh, I really shouldn't have had that top slide, should I? Rather topical. We all know that was nonsense. But the, so, yes, as I work for the European Commission, I would say that, wouldn't I? But, you know, there are lots of instances where falsity has come out. I was reading the number of retracted articles in science recently. It's a huge, especially in the biological and medical sciences, not so much in my own. But one thing I really found frightening, I was once recently asked for my publication this. Well, I haven't looked at it for years, so I thought I'd check on Web of Science. I found three publications with my name on, which I had no knowledge of. Okay, I'd just been put on to get a paper with Chinese authors into the system. I knew nothing about it. As it turned out, there was nothing too dramatic in them, but that's going on all the time. I used to be a director of a science publishing house, and they reckon that 40% of papers from China were plagiarized at one time. So do not get the feeling that all this peer review and all that nonsense is actually going to get rid of it. It's getting better. We have software packages to sort it out. But this was the big one, wasn't it? The MMR vaccine. And again, because of the huge amount of media coverage, and this is the media hyping it up, and I'll come back to that again in a little while, they can draw up and you start to say, but the fact that microwave phones, phones which put out microwaves into young children could possibly damage health is, of course, quietly forgotten. Okay, so who do we trust? Now, this is 2 years old now. I don't know if and you can't really see it. That's probably good for you. Do we have any professional footballers here? Apparently, they're pretty untrustworthy. Do we have any nurses here? I'm surprised we don't. They're the most trustworthy, followed by doctors. Now, this is really interesting that professors like Andrew and myself are up there at 85%? If I'm going to, and scientists are slightly less. Now, I'm a scientific professor of science, and so are you. So when do we come in? The average, are we at 83.5? I don't know. Are we trustworthy? But this is what the public, this is an Ipsos Mori poll, this is what the public trusts. We're in a very interesting position if 85% of the population trust us, when I actually don't necessarily trust my fellow people. So, I should say the bankers are near the bottom, would you believe? Vickers come up, if I went back, Vickers about halfway up. This is probably about par for the course, isn't it? Probably about right. And, of course, scientists are near the top. I was going to put in one or two other characters, but I had a feeling you might object. But for Christian, the truth is personal and revelational. It's nothing to do with what goes in our papers, necessarily. And if you abide in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth. You will know about the relationship between God and man. But on what basis is science truthful by comparison? And I ask myself, have we actually bartered the truth? Because we have so many stakeholders and pressures from outside. If you're an academic like I was, we're really looking for the next grant. So we've got to have something that sounds good. Almost all promotions in top universities are based on research output. Okay. I better not say anything what Bristol does, but one place I was at, that was the only thing that counted. If you're in take-up startups or in companies, it may well be investors you're trying to convince or trying to sell things. Also, too, we only see a very small part of scientific truth, and I'll come back to that again later. And I think we are called upon to look at the much bigger picture. So the whole area of abiding, I don't know if you've studied that here, was a book a few years ago, 2013, which Ben Quash wrote about how to abide in the truth. It was a very interesting book to read. It's a theological book rather than a scientific one. It's an old problem. Nothing really has changed. This is a quote from Plato. Strange times are these in which we live when old and young are taught falsehoods in school, and the person who dares to tell the truth is at once called a lunatic and a fool. So nothing very much has changed in this respect. A good egg, Plato, in some respect, because he knew what was coming up. Now, here's a few quotes for you. One of my great heroes is Michael Faraday, who was told by his boss, Humphrey Davy, to give up science because he couldn't afford it, go back to bookbinding, but he managed to stick around for long enough. Nothing is too wonderful to be true if it is consistent with the laws of nature. So truth is linked with consistency. It is the great beauty of our science that advancement in it, whether in a degree great or small, instead of exhausting the subjects of research, opens the door to new possibilities. Abundant knowledge overflowing with beauty and utility. I don't think you'll see that in any grant application these days. If I saw that in a grant application, I think I might back it. And this last thing is about poetry. I come back to poetry right at the end. I am no poet, but if you think for yourselves as I proceed, the facts will form a poem in your mind. Is that how you see science? A poem in your mind. I'm going to come back to that. I had to put this last one in because you all know the quote when he talked to Gladstone. And he said, what use is it? Gladstone said, what use is it? Well, sir, there's every probability you'll soon be able to tax it. And of course, that's what we hope with genetic engineering, that you'll soon be able to tax it and go on from there. Another favorite of mine is Ernest Rutherford, who we have a friend who is the great-granddaughter. And of course, his grandson was professor of physics here at Bristol, Peter Fowler. All science is either physics or stamp collecting. And I'm afraid it still is. A lot of science now is collecting data and not necessarily thinking about what those data mean or what the underlying causes are. So sometimes truth can be, did I collect the data properly? Am I getting too revolutionary? No, you're okay, okay. Now this is the next one about the history of physics. This is great, this one. Aristotle said a bunch of stuff that was wrong. Galileo and Newton fixed things up. Then Einstein broke everything again. Now we've basically got it all worked out, except for small stuff, big stuff, hot stuff, cold stuff, fast stuff, heavy stuff, dark stuff, turbulence, and the concept of time. So it's all done. There's nothing to worry about. I met at Cambridge earlier this year Carlo Rovelli. Anybody listen to Carlo Rovelli's? You know what's coming, okay? He's a great speaker and having a very interesting time with him. And one of the books he's written is about the concept of, what's it called? The concept of time, is it? The order of time, which is very interesting. A lot of his stuff starts to make you think. And he talks about rebellion, and I'm quite, this is my anarchist background. Rebellion is among the deepest roots of science, the refusal to accept the present order of things. Here we go, we're back to poetry. Perhaps poetry is another of science's deepest roots, the capacity to see what's beyond the visible, And he talks about time is defined by the second law of dynamics, and heat can only pass from a holder to a cold, hotter to a colder. So I was just trying to think of the Flowers and Swans song of that. Do you remember? Remember that one, the second law of thermodynamics? But what he does say, and quite a lot of people, theoreticians say this, that when you get down to the Planck time, Planck length, you actually, time does not exist. It goes out of the equations. And he says, Carlo, time is ignorance. How does that suit you? Time is ignorance. Are you ignorant? And again, he says, nothing is valid always and everywhere. Sooner or later, we come across things, something that is completely new. And so what I'm trying to tell you is that things that we think are absolutely true and can be trusted are not necessarily true. Another one of my favorites is this one. I think it's much more interesting to live not knowing than to have answers which might be wrong. And we're very tempted to give answers that fill in the gaps, as it were. And this is my favorite of all time. If you think that science was certain, well, that's just an error on your part. That's one I like to give to non-scientists. This next quote is from his book, Quantum Electrodynamics, which is pretty old now, where he's talking to a bunch of general people, and he's talking about light. And he just says, well, you're not going to understand anything I'm going to say, but stick around. It's like tonight's lecture, really. Stick around because my students don't understand it. He said, why is that? Because I don't understand light. Nobody does. Okay, so he's trying to get his students and the people who are attending his lecture to understand they're moving into the unknown, which we don't understand. Now, I'm quite a fan of light. I was head of the Rutherford Appleton Laboratory with the current UK synchrotron light sources, the diamond light sources, and I held the UK shareholding in that at 86%. I was used to hold the shareholding for the European light source, and I've been involved in light sources for the last 20 years or so. And so light to me is very interesting. And what does it do? It doesn't just illuminate, it does do that. It burns, you get sunburn. It transforms, you can change the structure of matter that way by knocking it around, knocking the atoms around. We use it every day in our fiber optics. It manipulates, you can use laser tweezers to move atoms and other things around. It accelerates. One of the experiments we did at the Rutherford was to accelerate electron by a pulse laser beam, which was the first example of showing you could perhaps obtain nuclear fusion by accelerators, and also interrogates by optical diffraction or reflection or X-ray diffraction and reflection, which we use every day of the week. Okay, now one thing that's quite interesting, though, light comes up so much in the Gospel of John. There are 33 references, apparently, and this is the one I like right in the first chapter, right at the beginning. The light shines in the darkness, but the darkness has not understood or overcome it. There are two translations, and theologians back one or the other, but I like the one that has not understood it, because we don't understand light, and darkness doesn't understand light. And light comes up so many times in those Gospels, and I just can't help thinking why it comes up so much. And this is the judgment: the light has come into the world, and men love the darkness rather than the light, for their deeds were evil. For everyone who does evil hates the light and does not come to the light for fear that his deeds will be exposed. And the well-known, I am the light of the world. Okay. Again, one of the Darwin lectures this year was by Peter Fletcher, and I've forgotten where he comes from now, but he is a vision medic, if I remember rightly. And he was talking about the visual system in its structure and functions confer a ready-made tendency to create perceptions, to see visions. What do you see? What do you see? It comes up constantly in the prophets, doesn't it, and elsewhere. What do you see? What do you see? And what you do is put onto that seeing your own perceptions and visions. And he says there are two parts of seeing. One is expectation. In other words, you bring your own background to it and thoughts. And the other one is the actual observed input. And by putting these together, you can come up with some pretty disastrous consequences. I have a talk which is called Seeing is Believing, and part of this talk comes from that. But we have to be very careful about our scientific observations in that we don't always see the reality because we're bringing our own perceptions to it. A little bit on optics. This was the first book on optics over 1,000 years ago, I think. I wasn't there. And then we got Newton, who rolled up, just finished rereading the biography of Newton. What a nasty guy he was, as you probably know. But he said that light was made up of particles. Then his great friend or enemy, Christian Huygens, said, no, it isn't. It's made up of waves. And then we had James Clerk Maxwell rolled up with his Maxwell equations up here. And then we had Einstein, who said, Maxwell, of course, said they're waves. And Einstein said, no, they're not. They're particles. And Richard Feynman's quote is, light is spooky. Okay. So where are we in all of this lot? You know, it does depend on which way you want to come. But I think Maxwell was in that earlier slide, did say something very, very important here. I should be very sorry if our interpretation founded on a most conjectured scientific hypothesis were to get fastened to the text in Genesis. The rate of change of scientific hypothesis is naturally much more rapid than that of the biblical interpretations. So that if an interpretation is founded on such a hypothesis, it may help to keep the hypothesis above ground after it ought to be buried and forgotten. I think we ought to remember that one time and time and time again, not to link the two together, otherwise we end up in very dangerous ground. Keeping ideas and opposite ideas hanging is not very comfortable. One of the preachers at my church said, we don't like tensions in what we believe. And I wrote to her afterwards and said, actually, I do. Why do I like tensions? I think new ideas come from it. This comes from a book on science fiction, but Roger Penrose, the mathematician, contributed to it. In the middle of it, he talks about how you keep opposite ideas which are in tension together. And he says it's a mark of a creative person who can tolerate dissonance. It's creative person's tolerance of discomfort, of dissonance, that makes new solutions possible. Now, I know some of you come from an engineering background, and that's why I put this lady with the bow and arrow. When I was a small boy, I used to get bits of wood, bend them, put a bit of string. Did anybody do that? Yeah, okay. Where's the tension? That way and that way. Which way does the arrow go? Yeah. So tension is not a bad thing, and we need it in scientific thought. So when we approach truths, we shouldn't see them as the end point, but we should see them necessarily perhaps being part of an output from tension between different ideas. And that's where, obviously, the wave and particle things come from. Not trying to resolve it, but starting to use it for good. This is another quote from Feynman, which is, religion is a culture of faith, science is a culture of doubt. I turned it around and called science as a culture of faith sometimes, and religion is often a culture of doubt. And I think the two are compatible, they're in tension, but it's a creative person that can cope with that tension. So honest doubt has a role in both. And I ask myself, is there a theology of doubt which can assist us in science? Opener for 10. I can see you all getting... And I think one of the big problems is in both science and in theology, we have this concept of keyhole theology, keyhole science. In reality, we know that we can only investigate less than 5%, I think it's 4% of the universe. Whether it's 68% dark energy and 27% dark matter, I don't know. All I do know is that some theoreticians say dark energy doesn't exist anymore. Certainly Revelli doesn't think it does. But I'm not the person to actually be able to answer it. One of the problems we have is we subdivide all these subjects down into the minutiae of disciplines. And that only occurred in the last 150 years or so. Before that, to be a scientist was to be a much wider person. I use the word, the German word, Wissenschaft for science, because it's so much more embracing than our word science. And Wissenschaft means scholarship, and includes the arts, humanities, social sciences. And I think that's really important that we don't divide ourselves up. And therefore, when I call myself a scientist now, I'm thinking of myself in the German term rather than the English subdivisions. And one can argue that universities have got this hopelessly wrong, and all our little departments all squabbling with each other. Not that it happens at Bristol University, I'm sure, but certainly all the ones I've been involved in. And I had nothing to do with it. And there's a big trouble if you go down the keyhole theology and keyhole science. And this is from a book which we've just been chatting about, Andrew and I, by Oz Guinness, who went to the same school as me, not that makes any difference. You don't see enough to come to conclusion. But once you see a little, it's difficult to resist trying. So you start to spread in the gaps. You start to fill them all in. Being insistent as well as inquisitive, we refuse to suspend judgment, and our wrong conclusions so misrepresent God, misrepresent science, that we end up doubting him. I think that's very profound, actually. We fill in the gaps quite often, and we don't actually know where the limits are. It's very tempting, very tempting. One of the books I really do like, and I do commend to you, is this one, Doubt, Faith, and Certainty. An old colleague of mine, Tony Thistleton, was Professor of Christian Theology at Nottingham when I was Dean of Engineering there. Shall I tell? No, I won't. And he was talking to John Polkinghorne, the Cambridge scientist and theologian, in the book, and this comes out of it, about the nature of honest doubt and where it fits, and where does faith fit, and where does certainty fit. And he says towards the end, doubt and questioning may open the door to new insights and a need to reappraise faith or belief. Some who claim from themselves absence of doubt and possession of utter certainty may possibly be masking a degree of arrogance beyond a display of piety. The biblical narratives anticipate partial certainty. And I would say our papers represent partial certainty in many cases, which is to be vindicated in the future. And the famous quote from 1 Corinthians, for now we see in a mirror dimly, but then we'll see face to face. Now I know only in part, then I will know fully, even as I have been fully known. I find that reassuring that there is an end to all of this. So what do we really see? Well, you will have seen this slide like this many, many times, that we only see this little portion of visible light, and yet the whole room is buzzing with different frequencies, and if you go down to X-rays or you go up to radio waves and all that lot, we know that there, switch on the radio in here, you'll be able to hear, you'll be picking up vibrations in the audience. If I can't keep you awake, surely those vibrations can keep you awake. I don't know. But we see so little, and yet we make such sweeping generalizations in the name of truth. So light illuminates. To what extent are we actually stuck in the visible wave band? Or is it dangerous to go beyond, because we don't know where we are going? I'm going to move on here, because I'm going to take the example of the sun. One of the cameras we built at the Rutherford Lab was to observe the sun on a project called SOHO. This is an image of the sun. It was a few, when was it? I can't remember when I did this one. It was 2014, but it hasn't changed much. The sun's orange and round, a few sunspots on it. That's the sun, a nuclear fusion furnace. It keeps us all warm, keeps the energy going. and we all like it. But of course, it's not like that. If you change the wavelength of what you look at, you suddenly see it's a seething mass of action. Now, we don't see that, or at least we couldn't see it if we just looked up and put a shade over our eyes. You wouldn't be able to see that. It's all orange. But of course, that's not the whole truth either, because if we put an aperture over the sun, there's the black aperture over the sun, we see all these magnetic flares coming out, thousands and thousands of miles that can affect radio transmission and especially things like aircraft. This is another project. Both these are NASA satellites, by the way. This is stereo where there are two. So we can see if that flame, storm is coming towards us, and we've then got 8 minutes to tell aircraft, you know, you may be in trouble for a little bit as that breakout occurs. That's the sun. That was actually 5 years ago. If you're worried, this is what it looked like on Wednesday. Okay. You can go on to the NASA website. You can pick up, I think it's two or three times a day, they put up all the information to show you what's going on. So, you know, it's fairly benign at the moment, but what about tomorrow? Who knows? So it's not what you see. I'll go back, actually. It's not necessarily what you see, what's really going on behind the scenes. My own subject is material science. I've spent most of a lot of life on microscopes like this. This is a Titan one with adaptive optics. And we are able to image atoms and make various things that are used in everyday life. Except, of course, atoms don't look anything like that. They're not solid ball bearings. And I had a bright student. I was talking at the Borough Academy in South London, a deprived area of London. And in the front row here was a young lady of Caribbean origin. And when I said this wasn't any good, you know, that it wasn't the truth, she said, but why do you do it? What's the point? I said, first of all, you should go to Cambridge to do natural sciences. And then I said, well, actually, it's good enough. It's good enough. We design most modern materials that are used for implants, that are used in semiconductors, using microscopes like this. It's good enough. But it's not the truth, because we get images that are not what's really there. This is one of my favorite pictures, this bottom one, because that is the basis for all the aluminium alloys you use for your tin cans and for aircraft and every other use that most aluminium is put for. It's all down to just one or two single rows of copper atoms, which is that sort of fuzzy bit in the middle. You can tell by the diffraction pattern. But there are those people like Plato who say, well, actually, that isn't true. That's not true. And that's when scientists challenge the truth. This top one you probably all recognize is Jocelyn Bell Burnett, who saw the blips on her radio telescope. She went to Tony Hewish, who used to be a colleague of mine at Churchill College, and she said, I've got these. He said, ah, get lost. It's not true. Then she persuaded. He got the Nobel Prize. She didn't get anything. Disgusting. Absolutely disgusting. It's not true. I mean, what she saw was something, and she challenged authority. This bottom one, I don't know if anybody recognizes, Dan Sheckman. I saw that diffraction pattern, which was published when I was a research student with a friend of mine. We saw it when the journal came into the library at Cambridge, and we immediately said, it can't be true. Now, I don't know if any of you know why that can't be true. Aha, we don't have electron diffraction people here. I was taught crystallography at Sheffield University, where I did my first degree, that you could have two-fold symmetry, three-fold symmetry, four-fold symmetry, but never five-fold symmetry. Six-fold symmetry, yes, or you can never have 10-fold symmetry. That is 10-fold symmetry. Can't possibly be the case. Everybody said, and we went away. I remember that evening, we went to do the experiment with a similar material, and we saw it. And we said, we must have seen this 1,000 times, but we dismissed it because we thought it couldn't be. He saw it. A little while later, Roger Penrose, the mathematician, showed how five-fold symmetry or 10-fold symmetry could fill space. That's two-dimensional paving slabs. If you ever go to Wadham College in Oxford, you'll see, those aren't the Wadham College slabs, but you'll see a path made out of these slabs that he can fill space. This is two-dimensional. He did it in three-dimensional. He got the Nobel Prize for it. Good for Dan. I met him fairly soon after he did that, and I still wondered whether he was telling the truth or not, whether he fixed it. There you are. Truth under power. And you need people like that who actually question what's going on. Then one of my great experiences was to attend the Nobel Prize giving ceremony in Sweden some years back, when the prize for physics went to two characters who did this experiment to look at the cosmic microwave background. from the edge of the universe. And we get fantastic information. This, I'm not a cosmologist or anybody who can understand that. But then we've got more scientists coming along and say, but is it really true? Because that left 13.3 billion years ago. We're just picking it up. But also, is there a wormhole we can get through into another universe? I also went to a talk where a theoretician said, yeah, you can get through to another universe. A photon can get through before the wormhole collapses. I don't know whether it's true. The mathematics completely baffled me. But I just like to think to myself, I have no idea whether that's true or not, or whether it is the truth. It was true for then, but is it the truth? I don't know. Okay. Perhaps I won't hang around with this, but I think we have to ask in these circumstances, where do we fit in? Are we true, or are we a figment of our imaginations? How can we enjoy the fullness of God when we see so little or understand so little? Is the earth an accident, or are we co-creators? I'd like to think we are. And in Tony Thistleton's book, which I mentioned earlier, Doubt, Faith and Certainty, he says we need ways of thinking, models or metaphors that try and enable us to live in this space which is true enough, but is not the absolute truth. True enough. We all live by Newton's laws. We call them laws, don't we, when they're not laws. And Newton's theories, which break down. But for most of us, for most of our lives, in fact, probably for most of us, all our lives, we live by them. How do we cope with that? Another book which I do commend to you, maybe that was, no, another book is called The Last Things That He Wrote. Now, as I said in the introduction, I'm a consultant to CERN. I go there once or twice a month. And it was set up really to understand where the big questions would be answered. What is really, really there? And this is the compact muon solenoid. In fact, of course, I've just lied to you again, because that's actually a composite photograph made by an artist in residence. You can't get far enough back to take that photograph of the whole thing. So he did thousands and thousands and thousands of photographs, and so that is a meta image of compact muon solenoid. So, you know, I've just lied to you so many times tonight, that's just another one. But it's huge. Absolutely huge, and it was one of the detectors that found the so-called Higgs boson. Now, Peter Higgs was in the same place. I don't know who this guy was. He does look a bit goofy, doesn't he? But Peter is there looking at seeing what came out of his theory. He wasn't the only one to go there. I drop in from time to time. And if you do want to come and visit, do let me know. I do organize visits there. And this is the evidence, the first evidence of the first run. I haven't got any other evidence. And you see there, absolutely obvious that the Higgs field does exist. Pretty obvious, isn't it? It's at 126 GeV, and you just see that little, you can see it better on the CMS data than you can on the Atlas data, but that's where that little blip is. Is it true? Is it true? Well, before the data came out, I knew the Director General, Ralph Dieter Heuer, very well. And we were in Dublin together, and he was just walking past me in the coffee break. I said, Dieter, have you found it? He said, 99%. Just walked on. Yes, it's 99.999% certain, statistically, that there is something there. But whether it's just one thing or many, we don't know. I'm not a particle physicist, so don't push me on that. But I like to show that you need to test these data to see if they're absolutely true. But of course, we don't know what's inside those. Are they really fundamental particles, or are there other things to find out? We know so little. Now, I'm moving on to something else which I've had a lot to do with, which is a movement which many of you may not have caught up in these nether regions of Bristol and the West Country, but in the powerhouse of Brussels, this is big. And this is part of a presentation I gave to the Competitiveness Council, the Council of Ministers, some 5 years ago, on the impact of what's called open science, or it was called Science 2.0. In fact, we're going right back to the past. We're going back to the Renaissance in many ways, that open science is here to say. And I said three things to them. I said, first of all, you won't understand what it is. Second thing is, we don't know where it's going. I said, the third thing is, don't regulate. Of course, what are they doing now? They're trying to regulate it, but there we go. Such is life. We've had 5 years. What is it? It's about sharing of information freely with each other. Instead of bundling it up and publishing it on your own, you make it freely available. And the quote which will come up is, all publicly funded research must be publicly available. This was the slide that I showed them at the time. That should have killed them off. But that was the ecosystem then. It's got much more complicated about where open science is coming from. From open data at one end, citizen science, open access, all these things all starting to form an ecosystem which wasn't around 10, 15 years ago. It's changed the whole way of which science should be done. Of course, academics resist it as if there's no tomorrow, but this is how we're going. And one reason for this is a slide from Microsoft, Tony Hayes' slide, is that we're in a period of profound change. So right in the early days, we had people, astronomers or astrologers, looking at the sky. Then we got the theoreticians, we got Newton's laws, Maxwell's laws. Then we got into large computers that could do massive simulations. Now in the business of data-intensive science, huge data banks coming through. CERN churns out about 50 petabytes of data a year. That's only 0.1% of the data it can produce. It has to get rid of the rest, otherwise it swamps the World Wide Web in 10 seconds. But some of the experiments being planned now are orders of magnitude greater than that. So the Elixir project, which is about genomics, is at the hexabyte data, as is indeed the new telescopes, the Square Kilometre Array, built in Africa and across Australasia. Those are going to turn out petabytes, as indeed paleontology is doing as well. So we suddenly got into an area of huge amounts of data in different locations, all trying to interpret and interact with each other. Where does truth lie in all that lot? Is there a pinhead or needle in that haystack? It's more than a haystack. It's probably the whole of the Midwest hay put together, and you're looking for a pinhead or a needle in it. How are you going to operate in that environment, and where does truth lie? I won't go through this. This is the panel I'm on, the Open Science Policy Platform, the European Commission. I've gone too far. You can see where it fits, but the ones I want to focus on, I'm going to look at FAIR data, and I'm going to look at citizen science, because that's where we start to see how it interacts with what I've been talking about. Things like rewards and incentives when you have multi-author papers because you're putting all the data together. Who is it who's going to be truthful in that? Who's going to pull the plug and say, I don't believe your information? Exactly 10 years ago, I was asked to chair this for the European Commission, which is a so-called high-level expert group. I've never met a low-level expert group. They're all high-level. but if you ever meet one, they're probably better than we were. And we were asked to look at what the impact of all this was going to be on research in Europe over the next 20 to 30 years. And we came up with these ideas that we were going to call them global co-laboratories. Okay? So they're huge laboratories, but in located in different locations. And very much they're focused on the big issues of society. They're not piddling around with little issues in disciplines, but it's about the big challenges that we're facing. And one of the things we talked about our vision, it's 2030, and we're almost halfway there. It's amazing. I can tell you much about this committee. It was a great committee, the best one I've ever been on, actually. We ended up in a monastery outside of Barcelona, where they made their own wine and olive oil. It was fabulous. thanks for your taxpayers' money for that. And what we said is that data science needs to be taught from primary school upwards, that this is going to be a new language, a data literacy to go alongside language literacy and mathematical literacy that's going to be there. The impact is that citizens start to be able to interrogate what scientists are doing. Shock, horror. We put ourselves up for analysis. But not only can they interrogate what we're doing, they can start to use it. And the media can use it as well and misrepresent it. So how do you get around that? How can we question statements made like they've already been doing on small scale, but when they get big, that's really big. Now, one of the institutions that's come out of that in the last 2 or 3 years, based in the University of Leiden, is an organization called GoFair. And FAIR stands for, what does it stand for? Findable, accessible, interoperable, and reproducible. Oh, it starts up there, okay. I ought to know it. It should be etched on my mind. I know it off by heart. This is a bioinformatics guy set this up, Baron Mons, and it's now global. In 3 years, it's gone totally global. And one of the organizations that came out before this, which came out of my report, was called the Research Data Alliance, which went from nothing in 2014, now has over 9,000 researchers in 140 countries sharing information. That's the scale of which all this has happened. But along with rapid scale, rapid expansion like that, come the issue of provenance and trust. And so we're back to truth and trust again. About the same time, actually a year earlier, I prepared this other report. You think I spend my whole time writing reports? Actually, I don't write any of these. I get journalists to ghost them for me, but I do recommend that if you want to get through the politicians. It was about the future of European research over the next 20 years. And those familiar with the European programs, this actually influenced the Horizon 2020 program. All its recommendations were adopted. But it was talking about preparing Europe for a new renaissance, going back to the past, going back to when scientists, in the wider sense, were Wissenschaft type of scientists rather than our own definition of scientists. And this was in the foreword by Jacek Potocznik, who was the commissioner, a well-known volleyball player, and a commissioner for the European Commission. Really nice guy, actually, an economist at the University of Ljubljana. And he talked about, we need this now, we need this idea of holistic thinking, which epitomized the first Renaissance. When scholars and artists moved around and chatted, whether it was Erasmus or Newton or whoever, and they talked to each other across disciplines. Now he's saying that needs to return, but it now needs to be everybody should be able to do that. Everybody should be able to do that. And that's what this report was about, and that's where we come from. In another report that came out from part of the European Parliament, again about 8 years ago, was based on this, that knowledge is no longer concentrated in the hands of a few. It can be created and shared by ordinary citizens everywhere, challenging the legitimacy of traditional sites of knowledge and information production, such as universities and the media. That's universities out the door as well. So, but somebody actually has to do the work. This was a very challenging report. It's now a bit dated, and it's been updated, about what's happening to the world population in terms of internet sharing and how actually the focus is moving away completely from Europe and even America towards Asia and Middle East and China. And we're seeing that now. And that was predicted a long time ago. And it's really happening. I have a slide of how internet access in India has just gone sky high, for instance. One of the things that came out just over a year ago is when the research councils, both the European Research Council, our own research councils, and other research councils like BMBF in Germany, got together and they came out with what's called Plan S. Everybody heard of Plan S? Shook my academic part of the world, which was saying, no, all these principles of open science have to be followed, and will become mandatory in the UK, I think it's next year or 2021. I can't remember which year it is. Okay, so first of all, we see the nature of science changing, and we see the way it's being done, and how it'll go forward in the future. So this gives us big, big issues. This is the basis, all publicly funded research must be publicly available, except for things to do with security and personal health. Nobody quite knows how to deal with those. And the question is, can you trust everybody else's? Can you trust everybody else's? How can you prove that what they've done is actually what they say they've been doing? How can you do that? So we all start to take over persistent identifiers, and we register as ORCID users and other things just to give ourselves, this Joe Bloggs is that Joe Bloggs that did that work, and we can verify what he or she has said. I've never heard of a Joe Bloggs that's a she, but I'm sure we can make it that way. And then we've got the whole thing is what you do about information that is actually exploitable. That's one of the things I've been working on at the moment. And how do you actually teach in this environment? How do you teach in this environment? So what do the high priests of science have to say in this particular environment when they have no control over anybody, or potentially no control? This is Citizen Science Lab. This is about 5 years ago now, 4 or 5 years ago. Don't bother to read it, but it was looking at how citizen science could be used for global challenges, and prizes were awarded and are still going on at the moment. So this is very much now part of what science is about. But if you talk to most scientists, they wouldn't have a clue that this is going on. And there are various projects of citizen science you've probably heard of. There's the old weather, which is rather fun, off the logbooks of the British Navy, 100-odd years ago. I just put in this just to show you my concept of Wissenschaft, includes Shakespeare. You can read words that have got to be recorded and actually checked from Shakespeare. And there's hundreds of projects like that. The League of European Research Universities, Bristol isn't a member, is it? No, I don't think it is. Imperial only got in because we created a Faculty of Arts with 6 people in that write history books because it has to be a full university. And I think there's only about 4 universities in the UK. But they recognized this about 3 years ago and came up with a list of recommendations on how to handle it. The next slide does have these recommendations. I don't bother to look at them but it's about how do you actually guarantee that the truth will come out of these exercises. I'll leave it, if you want it, I'll give you the reference to it. And now we come back to the poetry angle. This is by Walter Brueggemann, who's a theologian, and the use of fiction. And I'm going to come on to this, how we use fiction, how we use poetry. It's the daring work of fiction to probe beyond the truth, the settled truth, and to walk on the edge of alternatives not yet available to us. It is this probe behind our settlement that makes newness possible. And this is the work I'm doing in CERN at the moment in a project called Idea Square. And the next slide shows this. Why else come to Idea Square? It's a place where scientists and society meet to push the boundaries of knowledge and to share and explore new ways to reach societal impact through research and technology. A space designed for collaboration through curiosity, creativity, and science. And I love this one. A place where people have a license to dream. And this is the building. It's an old warehouse where part of the Atlas detector was put. You'll notice one or two features about it, that it's a flexible space, that people sitting on beanbags. There's one or two other notable features, like these glass cubicles. Do you notice anything else odd about that? Oh, you've seen the double-decker bus. That's the meeting room. If you've got a good idea, you run and ring the bell, see who joins you. There are other parts here, too, which you can't see. I know where they are, black blobs. Are they red? I think they're black, on the floor. If you find it's all too much, you're feeling yourself overcome, being worried that you're not fitting in, you go and stand there. It's called a hugging point. Somebody will come put their arms around you, say, it's okay, you're one of us, don't worry about it. Yeah, this is how it's being done now. You've got to come and see this. And groups are coming there. I'm working with the Royal College of Art at the moment. 2 years ago, they brought 20 students out as a pilot to do this, and we give them grand challenges to see how they come up. Last year, 420 students signed up for this course for 3 months. And the Royal College of Art have now got a formal agreement with CERN to pursue this way of teaching art students in the nature of science in the future. I tell you, it's hard work. I have to mentor these people, and you're doing about one project every 5 minutes to get through the numbers. But it's exciting. Cambridge University Engineering Department use this, they come out as well. Other groups come from Barcelona, from India, or from Australia. We put together from people from different disciplines and different cultures and say, here's a space where you have a license to dream. Okay, and you can play around on the bus. I've been on the bus. There's a video you can see of how it got from London to CERN. You have to check where the bridges are and how high they are and things like that. I alerted them to the Flanders and Swan song about the London Omnibus, which is part of it. There are lots of great videos there, really great ideas. Am I pushing it too much? Probably, but I love it. So that's really where I'm working at the moment, and I do encourage it. But the real reason is that the way science is being done has changed or is changing dramatically. And the nature of truth is changing dramatically. And I don't know how we're going to handle this. I don't know what's going to... I mean, part of me thinks there's going to be a big bang and we get rid of it. But of course, our lack of understanding has always been there. And one of my favorite quotes of Jesus is from the sermon, from the parable of the sower, as it's called. Of course, it's nothing to do with the sower. He just flicks the seed. And he takes a quote from Isaiah. And again, Paul uses it in his very last statement in Acts. Though seeing, they do not see. Though hearing, they do not hear or understand. In them, the prophecy of Isaiah is fulfilled. You will be ever hearing, but never understanding. You will be ever seeing, but never perceiving. So for me, one of the areas of Christians and scientists is actually being humble enough to realize that we don't understand and actually to seek answers that we really get to the heart of things and admit when we're wrong or not wholly in charge of the truth. And one of the things I think my message, if it's like that, I am a bit of a politician these days, to scientists who are Christians or Christians who have an interest in science, is that we've got to take our responsibility in this field very, very positively and not let it just take over. One of my, Andrew knows this, I've got a great burden that the Church of England ought to have a chief scientist who leads the way in science. Most of what I hear from the Church of England is after something's happened. It's too late. We want people to get in there in the front line. It means getting dirty. It means getting in with the political side of science as well. So we take our responsibility, and that our role as scientists is not just to be a priest in this environment, but to follow Jesus as being prophetic as well, and also to have kingly aspects of authority that we need as well. So we finally finish, "You are the light of the world. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on a stand and gives its light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven." I think those are very apposite words to the Christians who are working in, as scientists who are Christians, or Christians working in the scientific field, that we must take responsibility. I'm too old now to do it, and I find myself finding very few people of faith in places where political decisions about science are taken. I think that's it. Yes. So, I hope that gives you some thought. As I said, I'm an anarchist. I may be too disruptive, but there you are. Thank you.
Well, John, thank you very much. You've expanded our minds, and I think many of us perhaps haven't quite caught before just the way science is going and the challenges and also the opportunities it brings. So that's really great. Just before I hand the mic over to Tina, who'll go around and take questions, can I just ask you a question about, from your Christian perspective, do you think this sense that the scientific world is beginning to see that truth is more complicated than we thought gives us opportunities to speak into it as Christians?
Yes. I mean, that was, in some senses, my last point, my main point, actually, is that, yes, into this sort of maelstrom of what's going on, it needs people with a solid framework in which to work. Now, don't get me wrong, there is still a need for your microbiologist or your geneticist, whatever Chris is. You need that. But there's this much wider side, and that's where we need some frameworks, because we don't have any at the moment. And everybody's relying on systems for truth, but systems we know don't really help very much. We need people of integrity there who say, hang on a moment, that ain't true. We talk about peer review. I think most of the studies show that peer review is pretty hopeless. It's better than nothing, but it doesn't get rid of a lot of misuse. So yeah, I'd agree, yes.
So if you've got a question, if you put a hand up and Tina will bring the microphone, whilst you're thinking about that, I should say, can we just mention it's going to be on the web?
And certainly some of the references I've given, I'm very happy to give you if they're helpful.
I think we need to obviously make clear that we're not saying that just because something's not known in science, and that's our opportunity to say, aha, you know, that's our proof for God. So we're definitely not in the game of God of the Gaps.
It's not a God of the Gaps. That's
absolutely
definitely not the case.
Yeah, and I think almost as Christians, we need to be sort of holding up the notion of, you know, science as a good method to determine what is sort of reliable. And you know, as Christians in science, we celebrate science as a wonderful endeavour. And we're very keen to find out the scientific truth of things like climate change. I think we should make that straight. And I certainly feel that just if you find an explanation for something, it's something you can marvel at. The explanation itself is something to marvel at, God's inventiveness, if you like. So we're not threatened by an explanation of something. We can be more and more marveling at our amazing God. So let's just make that clear from the start. Questions?
Thank you very much. Thank you for that. Very thought-provoking, very anarchic, really, to be honest. Montaigne once said, tell me of your certainties, I've got doubts enough of my own. And of course, we as human beings don't like being uncertain. It causes a great deal of anxiety. And I suppose my heart rate has gone up a little bit since hearing you talk. And my eyes, my pupils have constricted, and my blood pressure has probably gone up as well. So you're not doing me any good at all in one sense, but in intellectually, a lot of good. And one of the things that I've always been interested in is the whole issue of paradox. And I wonder how you could comment on that, because some non-Christians point to me and say, of course, well, if God is good, you know, God can't be all-powerful and good. There's that paradox. But they're unhappy to take the paradox, the concept of paradox, as a reality. Of course, I've always used, as a mere medic, I've always used light as the paradox. Sometimes it's particles, sometimes it's waves. Mondays, Wednesdays and Fridays it's waves. Tuesdays, Thursdays and Saturdays it's particles. And Sunday it does what it likes. And so it's paradox. Where do you see this matter of paradox fitting into scientific thought?
Well, that's why I brought that quote up about things in tension, opposites in tension, being creative. And I think that's where you have to approach this from, because they are not reconcilable in my human mind at all. I can't do that. But I can have a concept that actually I believe in an all-powerful God, from, if one sort of draws back, would see things. But that's a matter of faith, I'm afraid. I can't say anything to you other than that. I do think it's good, though, to... this is the sort of person I am. I used to go to a lot of German conferences, and there'll be the Herr Doctor Professor, sort of godlike figure sitting there, and there'll be his student with the board and says, this, and I always used to say, but do you really believe that? And there'll be a look of shock horror that I might even challenge that what he or she had measured or done might not be the truth. And I think it is very important that we always seek something which is opposite to establish truth in order to reinforce what truth we know. I wrote a paper for a Methodist conference over 10 years ago now about where do new ideas come from. And I say, actually, a lot of new ideas come from saying, what happens if the opposite is true? And what is going to come out of it? Now, as I said, I can't answer that. And we've got the problem is suffering and all sorts of things where we come across these things. I have a fundamental belief that there is a God who does understand. But my job is to say, yeah, there is a paradox here. What can we learn from it, which is greater than trying just to resolve it? That's why I use the bow and arrow things. But there are engineers here who know more about it. This building stands up by balancing tension and compression. Your body, if there was no tension or compression in it, would be a blob of amoeba on the floor. There'd be nothing holding us up. So I'm not answering your question. I'm only to say I think use it creatively rather than try and necessarily answer when you don't know the answer. But I'm not being very helpful there. Sorry. There's somebody. Eric's over here.
Hi, Eric Halbert. Two related questions. One is about education, the other is about interpretation. Mm. I mean, if you, perhaps you could say, to start with, what do you mean by data education, which you said, it's distinct from science education or whatever education goes on. But if you've got this great universe of people talking to each other, this open science thing, you know in science, specialists don't understand even the next field. So you can't expect to share this information which people can't understand, apart from their own little bit. So interpretation is a part of it. So people, for example, a case where you might want to say somebody doesn't know about the merits of vaccination. They could look at look at the original data, or about global warming or something controversial. Look at the original data and make up their mind. Do you think they could, looking at all the specialist information? So education, interpretation.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you when it comes to the specialist.
That's what open science is about, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But let's go back to one reason I argued for this should be in primary school, because I felt it would be a wonderful European project for the European Commission to sponsor primary schools talking to each other about something simple like the amount of rainfall or bud coming here. And then they understand what is worth interrogating. So they wouldn't understand the thing, but they would know how to ask the person, the specialist, the key questions. Oh, yes. That's where I meant by it. Not that they could understand my data. Mine was written in a few bits of old paper and things. You wouldn't be able to use them
That's
at all.
Right.
So it's that. It's the ability to say, actually, I know enough about the way you've done it to be able to ask you questions. I can't ask you about the specifics.
So it's open science as well. Everybody is together and all these people. Are they going to interpret what they're doing?
Can you just say
that
again?
Yeah, you took it away from me. it's open science. You mean, are people going to... people are putting all their stuff up about all sorts of specialist information. How are people in even other disciplines going to isn't interpretation really important?
Yes, it is. Yes, I fully agree with you. But a friend of mine who I'm working with in Cambridge, I'm working on a project called the Future of Universities, actually. I just wonder whether universities in their current status is a thing of the past. I say that in Bristol Bay. But it strikes me we're getting more and more specialist, so that we're actually making it more and more difficult to share than we did in the past. But that's partly because of the complexity. That's quite true. But my friend, he's retired professor of divinity at Cambridge. He said, what we need are statespeople in this game who can bring together these people in a different way. Now, you may say that's worrying because that takes us back to the high priesthood of science. But I think these are the sort of issues we're looking at the moment.
I spoke to Brian Pippard about this many years ago, and he said, how can people understand this stuff? You know?
Yes. But his he did a very... I wasn't in his department. I was in the Department of Materials. But when I was there, he actually got rid of experiments in the first term. A friend of mine said they spent the whole time throwing darts at a dartboard so that they understood what their data was, so they understood the errors and other things like that. So there, I mean, it is a difficult one. I fully agree. But I think if we have the ability to know how to ask the fundamental questions, then that's probably as far as we can go. But we then need integrators, and that's what we don't produce very many of now. But it's an interesting point. Yes.
I just wondered, have you come across or interacted with any of the sort of social science thinking on dialectic, critical naturalism? The project that you're describing sounds remarkably similar to notions of epistemic relativity and such.
Yes, Roy Bashar, I wouldn't dare say I've done stuff at the level you're probably coming at. Let me just give you an example. I was asked by the European after the blow up, the nuclear blow up in Japan, when Switzerland and Austria and Germany wanted to stop all nuclear research, they asked me to chair the meeting to really stop the disruption in Europe by something going into the parliament to stop all nuclear research. Okay, Muggins here was the chair of this thing, and they got all the facts, the scientific facts. Yep. Had all those. We knew all about natural radiation. We knew about nuclear materials for medicine. Blah blah blah. It all looked great. The people who solved the issue for us were the social scientists, because they looked at the whole area of risk, and they said, "What is the risk of a social upheaval if all the lights go out in Europe compared with a potential breakout of nuclear fuel?" And they came through their analysis, they showed that there was much greater risk of social unrest if all the lights went out. Okay, so that's where we started to integrate social scientists, but far more than that, trying to get alongside them very early on. So I'm working with a group at Christchurch Canterbury on epistemic knowledge, which is starting to look at some of these things. I wouldn't say we're there yet, you know, but it's starting to move. But the value of social scientists in all of this, and the value of the arts and humanities as well. One of the things I didn't tell you about that went on in that bus, I took four philosophers there 18 months ago. And we came up with the idea, which we're going to pursue now, is getting a load of science fiction writers to come and join us. So trying to get us beyond the comfortable and look outside. But you are right, we're very far away from getting there yet, but it's starting to.
Thank you. You mentioned dissonance and tension earlier on and the creativity of these things. Can I put a question to you, which is that had you been adopted at birth and brought up in a random Chinese family, the overwhelming probability is that you would now not believe in God. Now, there are two questions I want to ask. One is, do you accept what I've just said? And the second one, which is the more valid belief? That of the English Professor Wood, who believes God exists, or the Chinese Professor Wood, who doesn't believe God exists?
Oh, this, wow. Where do I start on that one? Would I be an Englishman adopted by the Chinese, or would I be Chinese adopted by the Chinese?
Well, I intend that you'd be an Englishman adopted at birth by the Chinese.
Okay, well, as I understand it from my friend Colin Blakemore, who some of you may know, he's a professor of brain science at Oxford at one time, is something else now. He tells me there's more plasticity in the Chinese brain than there is in the European brain. I can't say whether that's true or not, but he tells me that. And therefore, my brain wouldn't adapt as quickly in China to their ideas. This is me wriggling out of your question, actually. whether I would adapt so quickly to the ideas. But of course, as we know, in China, there's a resurgence of Christian thinking. Well, it depends what you read, but it's emerging there. In fact, my goddaughter was out there with the Navigators for some years, so I know a little bit about what goes on there. The answer is I don't know. I mean, I wasn't brought up as a Christian at all. A very materialistic household in Oxford. My father was a shop owner and thought it's just wrong that I went to university. He didn't pay for me to go to university. I had to get my own money. So I don't come from a background which was in any way encouraging of where I am now. I'm not sure I can go any further. I'll have to ask my Chinese friends, even those that write papers with my name. Yes, and I understand that, yes. It's an interesting one. I mean, I often wonder what if I'd have taken a different path, whether I would be standing here today, you know, whether even without going to China. My father, he had four photographic shops. He desperately wanted me to take his shops over. If I'd have stayed with that, I wouldn't have been staying here today. I'd have been a highly dissatisfied person.
So from a scientific point of view, there would be no difference. But from a religious point of view, there would.
I suspect you're right. I mean, it's hypothetical, but not having been there, but the chances are, the probability, I should say, is that it would be correct. But I certainly was not brought up in any way at all of any Christian background. It was only when I was 14 or so that I actually started. And then I rebelled a lot as a student and all the rest of it. So I've been for the usual proving curve. That's why I'm slightly heretical at times. Only slightly. Maybe a lot. That's a nasty question, though.
Question about the interplay of knowledge and uncertainty. When you have a scientist talking to the Today programme and the presenter says, "So what's this telling us?" I'm sort of channeling John Humphreys here.
Yeah. And luckily he's retired. Yeah.
And a scientist then talking to a minister of state who wants to know, what should we do with these findings? How does this inform policy? Yeah. And then a scientist who's kind of in their natural habitat taught to show their uncertainty when they publish, to demonstrate the error bars in the explanation of the methodology and the results. So contrast the rather intolerance of complexity amongst possibly some aspects of the media and policymakers with, say, the summary findings of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, where you have lots of statements along the lines of the risk of something happening is more likely than not, brackets, medium confidence. And that is a very difficult tension, I think, for the scientist who's trying to explain the results in a sort of an honest scientific way. Have you encountered that sort of tension a lot yourself?
I have, because when I was running the Research Council, I had to deal with ministers and also with commissioners in the European Commission. So I know that back in 2001, I'd just taken over although I was based at the Rutherford Lab, we had a Northern Love called Dalsby, and I had experiments all around the world, big, big ones. I had 100 people working at CERN, for instance. And people have been talking about what happens after the Large Hadron Collider. For the last 30 years, they've been planning it. They assumed what the result was going to be. Luckily, they found it. My daughter asked them what would happen. She was about this high. What would happen if you don't find it? They said, well, we've got problems. But the idea was to build a linear collider about 30 kilometers long. It may get shorter now because of technology's improved, which will cost about 20 billion somethings. They're all about the same, aren't they? Dollars, euros, pounds these days. But it'd be about... we had a unit of currency called the Halliday because the guy in charge of particle physics said, well, it's about a billion. So we called it a Halliday, was a unit of currency. He never said what the currency was. But it's going to cost about that. You've got to realise in the accelerators that they use now, not the current ones, the ones that are used now, they're about £1 million a metre. So if you've got 30 kilometres, you can work out what the cost of the accelerator is, and then you've got the detectors and all the other stuff to go on it. So it's not a difficult thing to do. And yet, the Germans were going to bid for it. But I knew the German government wasn't going to support it, but there was a little line coming off the side. I said, what's that? And they said, well, it's a free electron laser. I said, what can it do? He said, well, we can get atomic resolution, but we can get time resolution of 10 femtoseconds. I said, I want that. Okay. And so I pursued that. And so when the minister phoned me up, it was David Sainsbury at the time, he said, John, we want to put this facility, this proton therapy centre up in the north of England. You've all heard of proton therapies now. It's all over the place. But then it was pretty new, certainly in this country. It wasn't in Japan. But, and I said, no, that's old science. I said, what we've got to do is go for the free electron laser. And he said, what on earth does it do? I said, well, it's an atomic movie camera. Got it, he said. I said, but let me just tell you a warning. It's only, we don't know whether it will work or not. There's only a 50% chance. He said, what on earth? You know, the expletives came out the front. And they didn't. He was actually very nice to deal with. I said, but if it does work, it completely changes biology. And I said, it's worth it. Our contribution is going to be over the 10 years to build it as well. About 100 million or so. I said, it's going to be worth it, because if it works, we have got to be in there from the beginning. And so you have to start by saying, and I could see the scientist saying, he doesn't understand, John doesn't understand. You know, you can't call it atomic movie camera, it got this frequency, it's that, and they want to explain everything. But you've got to get down to something which is understandable. And that's why I use journalists to write my reports, because they put things in a frame that gets the message over without. And the guy I work with was editor of the Wall Street Journal in Europe. He can put ideas over so succinctly that politicians use them. Now, the problem is with scientists, they think they can do it. I mean, I do it a little bit. I simplify things. There's another project called Clarin, which is a common language learning repository about what do words mean in context in different words. So what does the word science mean, for instance? I've given you two definitions, but actually, the way I've used it here might be different from where I use it tomorrow when I talk to my wife about science, because the context is different. So whilst we've got a dictionary definition, we don't have the contextual definition of how this word was used. That's a huge project, and it's started by a guy called Steve Clow at the University of Utrecht. He's a German medievalist. Okay? So I went to see Steve. I said, Steve, I can sell this for you. I didn't say it quite like that. I said, do you mind if I say to politicians this could help with intergovernmental legal agreements? He said, I don't care what you do, John, just help us. Of course, that's what it's doing now. So I had to interpret, and okay, I pushed the boundaries quite a lot, but I took what was a very basic arts project and was able to tell politicians, this is what it will do for you. And so you've got to start where the politician is, not where you're at. The same is true as Christianity, is you start with the person, not where you're coming from. Jesus always did that. He said, you know, always question you, always ask questions back and back, and let the person talk. We too often, as I've just been doing, talking to you and telling you things, but with this mass, it's difficult to have the interaction in the other way. But I do think it is important. So my local MP was, what's his name? Oh, anyway, he didn't know anything about science at all, and I met him on Didcot Railway Station. He said, John, I must do an A-level in physics. I said, yep, and we've got the best tutors you've got here. You know, I've got 900 of them with PhDs. You're going to get through. Oh, Ed Vasey, that was what it was, yeah. He went off rails afterwards, yeah. Became culture secretary or something. But anyway, but I think you have, that's the way to do it. But you're right, these interrogators on the radio and television try and twist you the whole time. They really do, so you have to be aware. But I do think we need spokespeople who can actually put these messages over. That's why somebody like Colin Blakemore is very good, actually. But the government doesn't like him because he tells the truth. Some of it. He is vice president of the British Humanist Society, so get something wrong. Colin Blakemore.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. He was he ran the Medical Research Council when I was head of the other research council.
I'm going to, I think, begin to come to an end, because John's got to get back to Cambridge tonight, or near Cambridge.
No, London tonight.
You're staying in London tonight, but anyway, you've got to get the train. So we should bring it to an end. I should just say about the media, I don't know if you remember this, John, but we were on a media training course together at the Faraday, and we were interviewed by a mock Today interview by David Cook, who used to do The Moral Maze. I was first on, and I'm in a right pig's ear of it, because what he did was move you slowly, slowly away from your comfort zone. John was the only one who he didn't trick. And I asked him afterwards why, and he'd done a media training course before. So there is a bit of a trick.
It's more than that. What happened was I had to appear before the Select Committee on Science and Technology in what's called an scrutiny interrogation. So they're trying to get at the government and misspent money. Okay. I had 3 months of training on that. I had a file this big. That's the hardest thing I've ever been through.
Well, it worked on that occasion. Anyway, John, we could go on. I'd love to ask you about artificial intelligence and big data, but we can't do that now. So thank you very much for extending our horizons. I'm sure most of us will go to bed now with all sorts of things buzzing and not quite sure what we've learnt, but we know we've learnt something because there's so much in there to make us think. So thank you very much indeed.